This, of course, is a Type 2 Bible study. We do a World News and Prophecy Bible study every once in a while, and this is one of those. I've got some interesting information this time, and I think Mr. Conway has set up the PowerPoint over there. I'm hoping everything's ready to go on him, and I'm on the first slide here that says the Middle East and the coming of the King of the South, which is the topic that I want to talk about this morning. Actually, now this afternoon a little bit. You're certainly welcome to submit 3x5 cards to any of the Bible studies for questions. We dealt with one in the last half-hour Bible study as well. There is an article that I came across which was quite interesting. Oftentimes, financial experts will write things when they are looking for areas in which to either invest money or avoid investing money because of world events in certain areas of the world. And oftentimes they have no religious motivation to what they're doing at all. They just simply see events clearly that are about to happen in the news. And sometimes those world events can affect the price of oil or the price of gold or the value of the dollar or value of other currencies. And so they're always looking for ways of investing and kind of saying, well, it looks like this is about to happen. So if I get in now and buy stock or buy that currency or whatever, it's about to go up. And they're always looking for a financial deal in which they can make some money. So it's not necessarily that this article is motivated religiously anyway, but they happen to have picked a subject that affects a number of the prophecies about to come to pass in our near future. And the article was actually by a gentleman by the name of Byron King. He is a resource expert for a financial daily letter that's called The Daily Reckoning. And he writes a very interesting article because I think it's fascinating because he covers a great deal about Islam and what is happening in the Middle East right now, what's about to happen in the Middle East. Even though he's not prophetic or religious in any particular way, he just happens to see things that are happening in the news and the things that are behind the news, because these guys are very careful to watch overseas news, to even travel to those areas of the world in order to write many of the things that they write. He begins in his article and he says, 1,354 years in the making is the title of his article. The new war that could rocket oil past $220 a barrel before 2011, by Byron King. He's the editor. Much of what follows, I've taken a lot of the information I've taken from his article. It was very entertaining the way he phrases it. He says, what could be 8 times bigger than the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan and lethal enough to at least double the price of gas and oil next year? Interesting opening. Brace yourself for the new and bloody wars, few saw coming. Nobody in the Pentagon will openly talk about it. Nobody in the White House knows what to do. But make no mistake, it could be a deadly surprise to many, and a threat to this country as well as many others. I call it a new threat because, as you'll see, there's not much new about it at all. The pressure's been building behind this one for the last 1,354 years. And certainly God is about to unleash it, and that's my comment, not necessarily his thinking, but I'll add my comments to what he says here too. And certainly God is about to do some interesting things in the Middle East. Yet for the first time in history, that pressure has found a release, and I'm imagining, he says, a volcano of hatred and blood. When it blows, the dollar will likely be thrown into a tailspin, and here's what will stun the still recovering world economy. Gas and oil prices doubling or even tripling by sometime early in the coming year, 2011. This is, of course, if all these events occur as they seem to be headed for, as what he's predicting. How, you say? Well, it's the last thing most people expect, from market pros to bumbling D.C. bureaucrats. But if nothing changes in what I'm about to show you, this is a page in future history books that's already writing itself. And he's talking about the future of what's happening in the Middle East. If I'm right, as many as 8 key Islamic countries are hurtling headlong toward a very bloody new war with each other. That's been 14 centuries in the making, and I suspect only a powerful forthcoming of the King of the South, that's my comment, will be able to intervene and will be able to reunite the Islamic nations once this begins to occur, once the volatility starts to take over. This could begin as early as the next 12 to 18 months, and with no less than 66% of the world's key energy reserves smack dab in the crosshairs. Sound terrifying? Indeed it does. Even if I'm only half right and we get an oil state stalemate, unlike anything the world has ever seen, you could see oil soar past the old high of $147.30 a barrel, well on its way to as much as $220 a barrel, with gasoline bucking against a ceiling of $8 a gallon, without any other events making it go that high. In other words, nothing else added to the mix, which could make it go even higher. We'll take a look behind the news here in a minute. I have some PowerPoint maps here I want you to take a look at that will kind of show what's happening and kind of give you a visual picture of what's going on at the moment. I have some of those I think will be of use and will reveal some of the secret revenge that's going on between some of the Islamic nations that's been kind of boiling for the last 1,354 years. Get ready to see some soaring oil prices and costs, maybe even a dead economy. It's very hard to tell how far this will go. If you remember the Nixon shock and the market collapse of 1973, some of you don't go back that far, stocks fell 43%. But that didn't stop oil and gas prices from quadrupling thanks to the oil embargo that occurred at the time. How about 1979 and the gas lines? Anybody remember those? I do. Even with Jimmy Carter's malaise and stagflation, oil prices almost tripled thanks to the hostage crisis in Tehran. It was oil that German submarines targeted in both world wars, and oil Japan gunned for at Pearl Harbor. Even Afghanistan is in part a battle over $3.2 billion oil pipeline. After the S&L banking crisis of the late 1980s, oil still soared in Gulf War I and soared again in 9/11. Despite the aftermath of the dot-com bubble and the bomb, it took off again in 2003 as bombs dropped on Baghdad in Iraqi War II. With politics as a driver, oil doesn't need a red-hot economy to take off. It can simply take off. Even the last peak of $147 a barrel came 6 months after the Dow first started shedding points and 2 years after the property markets turned south. Of course, events like these echo around the world because we live in a global economy and it affects everybody. Nobody gets the chance to just sit on the sidelines and kind of watch and be entertained but not affected. Let's step back so I can explain a little bit how this war begins. Long before $147 a barrel oil, long before the war over 9/11, or the war in Afghanistan, before either war in Iraq, the 1979 Iran hostage crisis, or even the oil crisis of 1973, all the way back to the land dinner that was served up one evening in the year 629 A.D., that's when it starts. Well, the murder that changed the world then and is about to change the world again occurred. Nobody could have known that the dinner they were about to eat would one day change history. Some say it was goat, others say it was lamb. Either way, it was poisoned. And the guest of honor was Muhammad, the controversial founder of Islam. It was just one bite, that's all it took. He tasted the poison and immediately spat it out, but it was too late. He would soon die, sparking a very bitter and deadly divide among his followers. See, when Muhammad died, nobody could agree on who it was that should take over in the family, and who the and eventually two major factions built up or formed, and they've been killing each other ever since as a result. On the one side, you've got the Sunni Muslims. They're the ones that were in Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, and many of the other countries in the Middle East. On the other, you've got the Shia Muslims. And it's the Shia that run Iran, and now run Iraq, as well as Lebanon and Syria. Think Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland, or Serbs and Croats in Bosnia. And even the religious 30-year war that ripped Europe apart in the 16th century. Only this Sunni-Shia split has built up pressure now for the last 1,354 years, and it's not been resolved. But it's only now that the pressure has found its ultimate release, with Iran driving a new Shia uprising smack dab in the middle of the most dangerous place on Earth, the oil-soaked Middle East. Isn't the Middle East already a mess? Yes, indeed, it is. And what's different is that too many in the West, right up to the White House and the Pentagon, don't get just how deep the Islam divide could go, or that it will run. Take a look at the map here. Let me give you another page. This is the first page now that I'm looking at, the kind of the black and white map here. It shows the deadly Sunni-Shia divide as it stands in 2010-2011. If it's black on this map, it's Shia ground. If it's mostly oil heartland and some of the most strategic territory in the Middle East, that's where the Shia are. One terrorist with a grudge can do a lot of damage in this area. Iran, all by itself, could even be a very deadly force. But can you imagine what millions of Shiites with a 1,350-year-old axe to grind can do in the Middle East? The 162-million-man march, we might call it, if you're looking for what can be done. Nobody knows exactly how many Shia there are right now in the Middle East. And that's because in all but four Middle Eastern countries, Sunni leaders don't bother to count them. They don't consider them real people. Sunni schools teach that Shiites aren't real Muslims. Shias don't get a seat in government. They can't become judges or even testify in high courts. In Sunni-run Saudi Arabia, Shias and Sunni can't even marry. For centuries, the Shia have been the underclass. But now, for the first time in history, they see this as their chance to turn the tide. How big is the tide? Well, hands down, saber rattling, all that Iran likes to do. It has the most Shia in its country, in Iran. 70 million Shia. But then you've got the liberated Shia of Iraq. There are 22 million Shia in Iraq as well, plus as many as 2 million Shia in Syria. In Iran-backed Lebanon, there's probably Shia as well, a great number, they don't know for sure, and up to 4 million Shia in Iran's top ally, Syria. Then you've got another 700,000 Shia in Kuwait, 500,000 Shia in Bahrain, 400,000 Shia in the United Arab Emirates, 300,000 Shia in Oman, and around 100,000 Shia in Qatar, according to the Pew Research Center in Washington. On top of that, as many as 10 million Shia in Yemen, another 7 million Shia in Azerbaijan, 11 million Shia in Turkey, not to mention the combined 30 million Shia in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Not all Shia want a revolution. That is true. There are many peaceable among them, but there are a lot that are not. But between 147 million to 162 million Shia spread across from Pakistan to Lebanon and Azerbaijan to Yemen, there's enough that do want revolution in that group, that it can become what we might call the river of secret revenge. Common blood running through the Middle East, all seeking justification for all the years they've suffered. The Sunnis are worried, especially in Sunni-run Saudi Arabia, and especially now. And there's a number of reasons why. The first reason why of course, is what we might call the new oil flashpoint. Number one is the real reason Iran wants the bomb. Everybody thinks Iran wants to drop the bomb on Israel. Well, you know, when you're confronted with two enemies that you hate vehemently, sometimes it's hard to flip a coin as to which one you want to use the bomb on. And I think that's kind of where Iran is right now. Iran used to be Persia, and it would like to be Persia again. It would like to rule all those lands of the Middle East. At one point, Persia was the biggest and the most powerful empire in history. Iraq, Syria, Turkey, Egypt, even Israel, the Persians controlled them all, along with Afghanistan and Pakistan and most of the oil-rich Caspian area as well. For 300 years, Persian armies held off the Roman Empire. Their scholars walked with Aristotle and Plato and influenced Greek art. It was the Persians who invented chess and the windmill, not to mention, some say, bricks and algebra and trigonometry and wine. I don't know how true those last are, but that's what they claim. The bottom line is, no empire forgets its past glory. It wants it back. And the Iranians resent losing theirs, and they'd like the chance to get it back. And with the bomb, they think they have some of the influence, some of the power they need to do so. The nuclear bomb went to Iran's crackpot leaders. I don't want to say crockpot, but crackpot leaders don't just want to scare Israel. They want it so they can throw a dark shadow over their Sunni Arab neighbors as well. Remember the characteristic of Ishmael. What does Ishmael do? What are the princes of Ishmael in the Bible? What are they constantly doing? They constantly quarrel with one another, don't they? They're constantly fighting each other. That's characteristic of Ishmael. And it's no different today among the modern descendants of Ishmael either. Let's take a look at another map here. Map number three. I think it's map number two, counting the first introductory page here, I guess, if you want to call it that. I'm trying to keep Bloomington on the right one. This one's got mainly Iran in the center, with Saudi Arabia down on the left, lower left. Iran's first move, of course, and this article is primarily from an Iranian standpoint, but Egypt is also 70% Shia and 30% Sunni, and Sunni run at the moment, on a very delicate balance. And Egypt's secular government under Mubarak is becoming increasingly more and more unstable and unpopular. The total control of the Hormuz oil choke point in the Persian Gulf and low power in liberated Iraq, the Iranians have a brand new foothold for kicking off the long-awaited Shia revolution. You'll notice two things. First, you'll see how Iran's Shia influence has spilled across the border into southern Iraq. We see that all the time. We talk about it among the troops. We talk about all the things that are going on in southern Iraq and the war over there. And southern Iraq is where you find six of Iraq's eight super giant oil fields. It's also where you find a key border with Shia Islam's mortal enemy, Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is Sunni. And for 8 years back in the 1980s, Saudi Arabia helped Iraq wage war basically against Iran. A very bloody war with Iran. And along with other Sunni governments, the Saudis gave Saddam Hussein and others over $47 billion to launch missiles and nerve gas attacks against the Iranians on their border. Gave them money to do so. Iran hasn't forgotten or forgiven. Imagine if Canada or Mexico gave money to Japan to help them bomb Pearl Harbor. How would you feel about Canada and Mexico? Wouldn't be real happy with them, would you? I don't think any of us would. Iran has waited to make the Saudis pay, and they're going to probably get their chance to do so. General David Petraeus made this statement on January the 31st of this year. He said, "Iran is clearly seen as a very serious threat by those on the other side of the Gulf front," talking about Saudi Arabia and its neighbors. the Sunni run countries. The second thing you see on the map above is that Iran has almost total control over the Strait of Hormuz. Anytime they want to shut it off, they just about can. Hormuz is the tight waterway that connects the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean. Over 17 million barrels of oil have to pass through the Hormuz every day. That's 40% of all the oil shipped in the world. 90% of the daily oil shipments from the entire Middle East. They have it kind of under their thumb. Except they know it'll probably mean war if they do try to control it, and there will be other governments who will not allow them to do so. With Hormuz alone, Iran could cripple the world overnight. Today, Iran backs Shia militants in Iraq. They give them money and guns. They didn't help Shia politicians take over the Iraqi government. Why? Well, because gaining control in Iraq takes the Iranians one step closer to their little twisted plot and their secret revenge that they're after, getting to Saudi Arabia, controlling all the world's oil. For another one of those steps, you just have to look a little bit further south at Yemen. And that's the next slide. I'm going to flip over to slide number, is it four or three? I'm not sure which one it is. I don't think I got numbers on them here. This one shows Saudi Arabia at the top and Yemen in the middle, and the Gate of Tears in the lower left, or it's called the Gate of Tears. And this is the new oil flashpoint number two, if you want to, looking for oil flashpoints. Yemen's ugly little secret. The Pentagon just tripled its budget on Yemen. Top U.S. General Petraeus just had a not-so-secret meeting with Yemen's president. And our own State Department calls Yemen a threat to global stability. What gives? It isn't a powerful country at all. Even ABC News just called Yemen the next top target in the terror war and a near-perfect haven for terrorists. President Obama just sent Yemen our troops, ships, and weapons. Here's what's happening, basically. The Shia revolution next new front continues here. Yemen's on-off Shia revolution gives, and the Gate of Tears oil choke point could soon give Iran a strategic backdoor attack point on Saudi Arabia. Yemen might be a failed country with a collapsing government, a shrinking oil economy, an exploding population, and not much anything else but lawlessness and chaos. That's basically what Yemen is. But what Yemen does have is position. It sits just at the tip of the Arab Peninsula, south of the other key Saudi border, and on the coast of another key oil strait named Bab el-Mandeb. Bab el-Mandeb, it means, basically, the Gate of Tears. Islam's next new oil war could easily begin. Nature, you've heard the old expression, nature abhors a vacuum. Well, for instance, in past history, there are a lot of points in history that a vacuum was filled rather quickly by someone. For instance, when a failed assassin's bullet burst a blood vessel in Vladimir Lenin's brain in 1922, madman Joseph Stalin quickly stepped in to fill the void. Likewise, when the Weimar Republic collapsed in 1933 and Hitler stepped into the power vacuum. Today, there's a new void about to be filled in the ravaged Middle East, and the lethal force that's stepping up to fill it or to step in could plunge the entire region into a new Islamic war. If that happens, nearly 66% of the world's oil supply will get caught in the crosshairs. There's still one unpredictable element in all of this: Egypt. If Egypt's government fails, which it has been on the edge of doing so for quite some time, and it teams up with a failed Saudi Arabia, the balance could swing back toward Egypt as the primary candidate, to probably fill the shoes of the King of the South. This would be assuming the U.S. and Europe have their fill of Iran and maybe reduce them to a third-rate power. Who knows? That may be where we get involved the next go-around, in weakening ourselves. Next, of course, is the soaring of the energy prices that can hit almost any aspect of our life and pummel any economy. And like Hormuz, most oil states in the Red Sea can't get a drop of oil without shipping it through the Bab el-Mandeb. Over 3.3 million barrels go through there every day. Blocking this choke point alone could slap a $30 political premium on the price of every barrel of oil. But there's even a higher and bigger threat that's also taking shape. For the last 6 years, Yemen has fought a vicious and bloody war with Shia rebels. These rebels are poor. There's no way, says a Yemen general, these rebels could fund and fight this war without, with the pomegranates and the grapes that they have. There is undoubtedly Iranian support. They just don't have the money to fight this war. But the Iranians are supporting their Shia rebels in this country. Iran loves to buy loyalty. They're good at that. They've done it in many occasions in the past. Take the $1 billion Tehran now donates every year to Hezbollah and the terrorists in Lebanon, or the billions they give Syria's Shia president to build cement factories and car factories and power plants and storage silos. In return, Iran gets Hezbollah's Arabic-speaking terrorists to run militant Shia training camps in Iraq, and gets Syria to distribute Iran's money and weapons to others in the Shia network. They get all kinds of advantages with their money, what they can do. The secret money Iran sends to Shia rebels in Yemen could soon have a payoff as well by opening up another route for a backdoor Shia access to Saudi Arabia. Yemen's rebels have already hit towns across the Saudi border, and the Saudis have hit back, losing dozens of troops in the process. We're just in the very beginnings of this conflict, just in the last 2 or 3 months. How bad is it? Well, so far, 50 Saudi schools along the border have had to close. Another 240 border towns have already been evacuated. And Saudi jets have already dropped bombs in Yemen. We're at the edge of a full-scale war. What exactly has the Saudi, what is it that's got the Saudis scared? What are they afraid of? Well, that's where we get to slide number 5 here. And this shows Saudi Arabia in the center, surrounded by flashpoints, things that are going on. Yemen's rebels have succeeded in doing a great many things more than just closing schools on the border. What exactly has the Saudis so scared? Well, Iran's final prize, we might call it, Saudi oil. That's what they're after. I think Iran's plot for secret revenge could succeed, but it isn't entirely in sync with Bible prophecy, at least as I see it. Of course, it could evolve into other scenarios that end up fulfilling Bible prophecy. It's hard to say. It would require a number of changes after the point, allowing Egypt maybe to come to the forefront as the King of the South after maybe Iran has been put down in some way. But the threat alone on our volatile economy could be enough to kick oil prices much higher and bring financial demise on this country without too much difficulty, and sooner than you might think. For instance, our CIA and Britain's MI6 and another top spy agencies, other top spy agencies, say that Iran could have a working nuclear bomb as soon as April of 2011. 1 year from today, working. The Times of London uncovered a confidential document that says Iran already has a neutron initiator ready to test. That's basically the part that you need to trigger the warhead. And Der Spiegel, the German magazine, says Iran may have, or may even have, the tech and the material to build a simple nuclear bomb or dirty bomb before the end of this year. But the bomb is just the beginning. Even if we go ahead, or even if the go-ahead to build a nuke ever comes from the top Shia clerics in Iran, the more immediate danger is a wildfire of Shia-Sunni unrest, starting in Iran's new hotbeds of Shia support and spreading across the rest of the Sunni-run oil states. with the richest oil fields, of course, and the world's richest oil nation as the final battleground, talking about Saudi Arabia. Take a look at the last map here. I think this is maybe number five or number six. Oops, that was the last map. I know I've got it written in my notes here to go to the last map. Anyway, let's stay on the last map. It's number five. Saudi Arabia. Suddenly, Iran has its mortal enemy, Saudi Arabia, surrounded. Millions of Shia even live on top of the Saudis' own biggest oil fields, which is kind of amazing. As you can see, Saudi Arabia looks, in many ways, like a sitting duck. Iran has a Shia network that reaches from Afghanistan to Lebanon. Once again, more connections building along the Persian Gulf, Yemeni Shias to the south, and Shia connections along the oil-rich Caspian Sea. You could see this spread to the nearly 2 million Shia that live and work in Saudi Arabia's oil fields very soon, even though that's exactly what the Saudis and our own Pentagon hope will never happen. As you read this, big and small Gulf states are piling up weapons, stockpiling anti-missile batteries, and sandbagging their oil terminals, ports, and water desalinization plants. Abu Dhabi alone has already bought $17 billion worth of U.S. anti-missile hardware, and the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia just splurged on weapons to the tune of $25 billion. As you read this, our own F-16 fighter jets, Patriot missile systems, giant cruisers, and up to 20,000 more U.S. troops are quietly digging in for an epic fight that could spread past Iraq and Yemen and even to Qatar and the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, all to get ready for what could be the fight of a lifetime. Say hello to the jihad generation. It's not just our experts saying it. Leaders in all three of America's biggest Middle East allied countries, Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, claim the epic Sunni-Shia showdown is in the cards. They're preparing for it. At the same time as our naive President Obama is rewriting the text of our war on terror to not include the word Islam in any part of the expression, I don't know whether you realize that that's coming, but it is. He's going to remove that. We used to call it Islamic terrorists or Islamic religious fanatics or things like that. We can't use the word Islam anymore in all of that because Islam really isn't our enemy. The war could start from any one of the flashpoints that I've named and they're on the map there. But no matter how it starts, Saudi Arabia is where it's most likely to end up. Well, why? Not only is Saudi Arabia home to Mecca, Islam's holiest place, but it's also home to the corrupt and U.S.-allied Royal House of Saud, considered an insult to most of Islam. Think about it. In a country where they'd cut off your hand for stealing or whip you for holding a glass of whiskey, Saudi princes gorge on cocaine, prostitutes, gambling, palaces, and more. All while the vast Saudi underclass starves on less than $6,000 per year and 30% unemployment. And as many as 2 million of that underclass is Shia. That's just in Saudi Arabia alone. With a 1,354-year-old axe to grind and billions of dollars in oil revenues as the prize, it's pretty hard to look away for Iran. It's a near-perfect formula for a full-blown war, and the fuse is already lit. Iran is ready to assert its place in the world. Think Japan or Germany in the 1930s. The threat is there, it's large, and it's not going away anytime soon. How the world responds, we can't be entirely sure. But I can tell you how oil could respond. By exploding to a new record high in price. Possibly as high as $220 a barrel by the spring of the coming year, with gas not topping out until it's reached $8 a gallon. That's very bad news for millions around the world, but especially for the economy already on the edge, like our country. Have no illusions. Any military response on any front could only accelerate the spike in the price of oil. Now let's go over to Daniel for a minute. talk about some of this that's developing and what we're seeing. In Daniel chapter 11, Daniel tells us as much as we really, most of what we know about the king of the south, and some about the king of the north as well. Daniel chapter 11, verse 4, it says, "And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken, and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others besides those." It's kind of interesting that we're talking about Alexander the Great here in this verse. That's basically what's being talked about, and Alexander the Great's empire coming apart and being divided at his death. He died at 32 years of age in 323 B.C. And his empire basically ends up being divided among his generals because he doesn't really have any offspring to pass it on to. By 301, there's a major battle that occurs at Ipsus. And in 301 B.C., that occurs shortly after his death. By 303 B.C., we find that the four generals have basically divided four kingdoms between themselves. So they've broken things up between themselves. And these are basically the four leopard heads that are mentioned in Daniel 7, verse 6. I didn't go over there yet, or I wasn't planning on going over there, but they are mentioned there, the four heads of leopards. These are the four generals that descend from Alexander the Great. In verse 5 now of Daniel 11, it says, "And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes he shall be strong above him, and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion." The four divisions of Alexander's empire were basically the Ptolemies that took over. Ptolemy Soter was the first one, and they took over Egypt, the area around Egypt, part of Syria, a little bit of Judea. The second major area that the second general took was Seleucus. Nicator was his other name. He takes Syria and Babylon and the territory east to India. The third general's name is Lysimachus, and he takes Asia Minor, or modern-day Turkey, today. The fourth general, Cassander, takes Greece and Macedonia. Now we find in chapter 11 a prophecy follows the two individuals here, the two of the most prominent generals, who are now kings, who begin to develop. The king of the south is Ptolemy, and the king of the north is Seleucus. In Daniel, well, let's read verses 5 and 6 here. I guess I read verse 5. "His dominion shall be a great dominion," and then verse 6, "And in the end of years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north and make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of arm, or the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthens her in these times." And find it basically the king of the south shall be a great dominion, and indeed the Ptolemaic Empire was a great one for the short numbers of years that it existed until the Roman Empire conquered it. Historically, we do find that the king's daughter here in verse 6 was Bernice. That was her name. She was very shortly, or killed very shortly later by Antiochus's first wife, Thais, who also killed Antiochus about 252 B.C. Now, in verse 7, it says, "But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail." Again, this is another interesting area here. maybe I should read all the way through verse 10 here and then kind of summarize it. And shall also carry captives into Egypt, their gods with their princes, with their precious vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. In other words, he's going to outlive the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. But his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up even to his fortress. In verse 7, this young lady, Bernice, was avenged by her brother, the next Ptolemy, Ptolemy Euergetes III, who invaded Syria as far as the Euphrates River. He killed Leonidas, and the Holy Land now changes hands once again. In Daniel 7:6, we find the four leopard heads who follow Alexander the Great. They're mentioned. Ptolemy, the king of the south, here in conjunction with the eastern king Seleucus, attacks the king of the north and is successful in taking the booty back to Egypt with him. And he outlives the king of the north historically as well. Antiochus III, the new king of the north, does return to take back what he's been, what's been taken from him in Palestine, and in verse 10 he overflows and he passes through the Holy Land, Judea, and reclaims his kingdom. Now the important thing to notice here is this constant flowing back and forth of these four empires, of these four generals, and now king of the north and king of the south, sometimes allied with each other and sometimes not, but they're flowing back and forth over the Holy Land, over Judea, over Palestine. And, of course, Palestine belonged to one of them at one time, initially, basically, I think, to the king of the north. But the king of the south takes it, and then the king of the east takes it for a while, and there's this overflow back and forth. What do you think's happening to the people in Palestine and in Judea? They're suffering greatly with all these kings coming to and fro and back and forth and over and back. You know, anytime an army crosses into your country and goes into the next country and fights and comes back through again, what happens? Well, they take and they steal and they destroy and they pillage and they do whatever they want as they pass through. And this is constantly happening to the Holy Land and the Holy People at this particular point in time. So, you know, they're suffering a great deal. Verse 11, and the king of the south shall be moved with choler and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north, and he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. And now we find Ptolemy the fourth, king of the south, is upset by Antiochus, the king of the north, his recapture of Jerusalem and Palestine. He's taken back what belonged to him in the first place. And Ptolemy the Fourth fields a huge army for the time, and he attacks Antiochus the Third, the king of the north. He is successful again in all his back and forth. Of course, the people of Palestine are suffering again through all of this, and many are killed. Verses 13 through 16 now takes place, or begins to take place, around 200 B.C., for the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers of your people shall exalt themselves to establish division, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and cast up a mount, and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that comes against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in a glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. Of course, the glorious land being Palestine. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give them, or shall give him the daughter of woman, corrupting her, that she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. Now, let me go back and kind of summarize this verses 13 through 16 a little bit. It's taking place around 200 BC, as I said. We now find the king of the north, Antiochus III, mustering a vast army and reclaiming all of his kingdom just after Ptolemy IV dies in 205 BC. The importance here of all this history, of course, is to show the back-and-forth action, but I'm kind of giving you blow-by-blow as it happens, of these armies passing back and forth across the Holy Land. It was a terrible trial for the people of God and the people in the Holy Land. In the future, how much back-and-forth action is there going to be between the king of the north and the king of the south? I don't know for sure. I'm not willing to say how much there may be or how long or how many years it may go on or how much of it happens before the end time events actually really pick up and take place. I don't know, but the prophecies do repeat themselves frequently in the Bible, and that's probably what's happening here. Verses 17 through 19, I just read verse 17. After this shall he turn his face unto the isles, and shall make many, or shall take many. But a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. In verse 17 we find basically the first Cleopatra. Not the famous one of 31 BC, the daughter of Antiochus, marrying the son of Ptolemy IV, or Ptolemy Epiphani, I guess is the way it's pronounced, Epiphania, a number of ways you could probably pronounce it from depending on whether it was Greek or Latin, but appearing illustrious or glorious is what his name means. The daughter of Antiochus wants Egypt, but not for her father. She doesn't want it for her dad. Amidst all of this, a Roman general enters the scene by the name of Lucius Asiaticus, who defeats Antiochus completely in 190 BC at the Battle of Magnesia. So now we find the Roman Empire is part of the mix and part and parcel with what's going on in the Middle East. And the King of the North concept begins to be prophetically fulfilled by Rome taking that role. But there remains now a new king of the north about to come on the scene here in Daniel 11, verse 19, in 187 BC. And his name is Antiochus Epiphanes IV, and he is really a bad boy, I guess is the best way to put it. Verse 21, and in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom. But he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. It's an interesting prophecy about the king of the north, whom we would refer to as the beast. A very vile person, as the King James translates it in verse 21. He stands up in place of a short timer in verse 20, basically, Antiochus IV, who is a type of the coming beast. Daniel 8:11 identifies him a little bit further. This is now about 176 BC, and Heliodorus, the tax collector and the temporary ruler in verse 20, is driven out by Seleucus IV of the Eastern Empire. He leaves no heir, but his younger brother Antiochus Epiphanes IV comes to the throne suddenly with surprise and flattery. The coming of the beast is with surprise and flattery. Verse 22, and with the arms of the flood shall they be overthrown from before him, and shall be broken, yea, also the prince of the covenant. Let's read through verse 24. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall become strong with the small people. He shall enter peaceably, even upon the fattest places of the province, and he shall do that which his fathers have not done, because he claims to do it all in the name of peace. Nor his fathers' fathers, he shall scatter among them the prey, and spoil and riches. Yea, he shall forecast his devices against the strongholds, even for a time. The last part of verse 22 concerning the comment about the Prince of the Covenant was fulfilled because Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth attempted to replace the Jewish high priest with a non-Levite who was subject to him. He was so tired of the Jews' uprisings that he decided the only way to undo them was to basically undo and control their religion. And he saw the person who controlled their religion as being the high priest. So he figures, I'll just take the high priest out of his authority, and I'll put my own guy in for the high priest, which of course infuriated the Jews beyond belief. So he works deceitfully against and to overthrow the holy people, the Jews here, and they have a lot of trouble with this guy. This beast of the future is going to do the same thing, or attempt to do the same thing with the Jews around Jerusalem and the holy place, or the true church and God's people as well, if he can. But many in the church will be protected from him, and his flood of an army, we find in Revelation 12, they're going to be protected from. We sometimes call these, well, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say that. We find that he is successful for a while in terms of taking over the holy place and protecting the place of Jerusalem, or whatever, if you want to put it that way, the holy place. Verse 25, and he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall forecast devices against him. Again, verse 25, this is probably around 171 B.C. What we're seeing is a series of prophecies about the king of the north and the king of the south all beginning to fulfill themselves and happening in the past, but we're also looking at types of what's going to happen in the future. In 171 B.C., the Ptolemy, who is the king of the south ruling in Egypt, Ptolemy Philometor, is confronted by the king of the north again at this point in this what we might call a final battle, and is again defeated by treachery among his own officers, and he's outwitted by Antiochus the Fourth again, verses 26 through 27. Verse 28. Then shall he return into his own land with great riches, and his heart shall be against the holy covenant, and he shall do exploits and return to his own land. So is he going to be real friendly with the people in Palestine as he passes back through on his way back to his own land? No. Not very much at all. Antiochus is vicious, and he does mischief in the Holy Land around 168 B.C. Then he returns again to plunder Egypt in verse 29. At the end of verse 29, a transition begins to occur here. We move from what has happened historically to what is now prophetic and has not yet occurred. So if you want to draw a little pencil line in your Bible there, at the end of verse 29, things begin to change at that point. We go from what is history to what is going to become history in the future. A very important transition. Now, take a look at verse 30. For the ships of Chittim shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return and have indignation against the Holy Covenant and against the Holy Land, obviously, as well. And so shall he do, and he shall even return and have intelligence with him that forsake the Holy Covenant. Or, I don't know what you want to call that, he's going to forsake their religion, or he's going to try to get the Jews to forsake their religion at this point, turn them against their own beliefs. And I shall stand on his part, and they shall pollute the sanctuary of strength, and shall take away the daily sacrifice. Ah, they shall take away the daily sacrifice. And they shall place the abomination that makes desolate, the placing of the abomination of desolation in the holy place, in verse 31. And verse 32, and such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt by flatteries, or shall he corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits. And they that understand among the peoples shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame and captivity and by spoil many days. Now, when they shall fall, they shall be helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. In other words, there are going to be a lot of people deceived in this process. Between 176 and 163 B.C., to back up a little bit, Antiochus Epiphanes IV takes away the daily sacrifice in the temple, and he pollutes the sanctuary, and he sets up the abomination of desolation. Verse 32 is very interesting prophetically. Apparently he corrupts those Jews who were willing to be corrupted and betray their covenant by flatteries. Later in the verse, we see some standing fast to the covenant with God. So prophetically, the same thing would probably be true in terms of Christians at that time, and concerning the future beast as well. He's not going to be friendly to the servants of God because he's heavily influenced by Satan. Verses 33 and 35, we find the true believers and the people of God being persecuted by Antiochus the beast. The ones faithful will be helped by God through this difficult time, but there will be many who don't hold their covenant with God and they betray their Savior. Verses 36 to 39 seems to be a description of the beast in the end times who exalts himself above gods and then above the true God. And we find the Roman emperors magnify themselves very much like that as well as gods. The god of forces and fortresses, even having to do with arrows and munitions and other things we find in verse 38. Many refer to the god of warfare, which the beast seems to be a worshiper of, or maybe thinks that he is the god of warfare. I don't know. Now, verse 40, from this point on, we're beginning to deal with things that are yet to be fulfilled again. After verse 39, the chapter begins to deal with Ethiopia and the African bloc of nations and their alliance with the king of the south, who begins to push at this king of the north in the future. And clearly the king of the north defeats the king of the south here in the end times as well. But how does Egypt fit into all of this? I don't know. I don't know how Iran fits into all of this. All I can see is that there are certain scenarios of what's likely to be happening at the end. Tidings out of the north and out of the east disturb the king of the north after he's defeated the king of the south, and he begins to go back north again, and he meets great armies around Jerusalem right at the time of the end. Jesus Christ has to return at this point in time to stop them from destroying mankind. A lot of interesting things are happening prophetically at this particular point. Clearly, the Middle East bears a great deal of watching, doesn't it? There's an awful lot of things that can take place. There's an awful lot of different scenarios that can build up here and cause war in the Middle East, of course, which shuts down basically any economy that's based on oil around the world, doesn't it? It doesn't let us out. It doesn't let a lot of nations out. A lot of people are going to go mad. Even the Chinese are loading a huge amount of oil. In fact, I think this year they get very close to reaching the same level we are in terms of oil. I hope I've introduced some concepts to you maybe hadn't thought about before, some scenarios that could very well be happening in the Middle East that we're about to see occur. And because the Middle East is so volatile, it's hard to tell, it's hard to set up an exact scenario of how all of these things take place in order to see who ultimately comes out as the king of the south and who ultimately comes out, of course, as the king of the north. We'd really like to know who that is, the beast. But it's hard to say. There's so much volatility here and so many scenarios that could take place and so many directions it could go. It'll be very interesting to see what happens. Any questions before I quit here? Any questions or thoughts? Anybody? I think it is kind of interesting to look at the Middle East from a slightly different angle. We've always thought, you know, Iran is going to have it out with Israel. Well, maybe. Maybe not. Hard to tell. A lot of things could transpire. Okay. Well, I don't have any questions over here, so I'll go ahead and end it. We can break and come back at 2:15.